Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca, and my co-host, Michelle Chalcedusky, an editor of Global Research. My guest today is Dennis Halliday, and I hope my listeners have memories that at least go back to the 1990s, when Dennis spent most of his very distinguished career doing UN development and humanitarian work. And in September 1997, he held a position as Assistant UN Secretary General for UN Humanitarian... Oh, let me get this right. Assistant Secretary General as UN Humanitarian Coordinator in Iraq during the period when the sanctions were in force and all the damage that they did. And a year later, Dennis resigned. And I've got the quote, at least the important part of the quote. He resigned saying that he had been instructed to implement a policy that satisfies the definition of genocide, a deliberate policy that has effectively killed well over a million individuals, children, and adults. And Dennis, I don't have your precise words, but I believe you added that 5,000 Iraqi children, roughly, were dying needlessly each month because of these horrific sanctions. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Steve, good morning. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm so delighted to have you on. I have quoted you a number of times after I began writing about 3.5 years ago in my retirement. The Iraq War had begun in the second one in the March 2003, and oh, I've written a number of times about it. And just on the 1990 sanctions, Dennis, I needed to remind myself of this, and this was in an article I wrote months back, that UN Resolution 986 in 1995 established the sanctions, and a later UN report that came out in 1999 revealed just how horrific they were. Authorized the oil for food program. The sanctions began just days after Saddam entered Kuwait in 1990. The sanctions were implemented within 3, 4, 5 days after that. The oil for food program was authorized by UN Resolution 986 in 1995, and it really was hopelessly flawed by design. A UN report in 1999 revealed that only about $74 of food per year, per person, was allowed, or about 21 cents a day, and about $15 worth of medicines per person a year, or about 4 cents a day. And the sanctions prohibited all sorts of essential items that had nothing to do with security, but they were called dual use and thus blocked, like pain-killing drugs, chemotherapy, ambulances, all kinds of things, chlorine to purify water. And, of course, this contributed greatly to the killing of all these people. Oh, Dennis, we have our first break in a minute or so, but let me let you begin with your experiences and what you generally get asked to talk about when you deliver so many talks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I must admit that the sanctions era, which I guess is 1990 until the end of 2003, is over. The consequences are there to be seen, and the invasion has made it worse, and the occupation has made it worse still. So I tend to focus more on that today and the current situation. And
the current situation. Dennis, that music means we need to take a break. Let's do it, come back, and then we can talk about what's going on now.
Good. Okay.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm on with Dennis Halliday. Dennis, let me let you pick up because you discuss this so often when you're asked to go out and give talks. So let me let you take over and give your perspective on what's going on in Iraq or any other world topic currently.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, I use sanctions today less to talk about Iraq and the consequences of those sanctions. And as you suggested, over a million Iraqis were killed by the United Nations by imposing and sustaining sanctions, which had built-in genocidal impact. I now use that as an example of the failure of the United Nations Security Council to manage itself and its resolutions in a way that is compatible with international law and the Charter itself, and particularly discussing the five veto powers, Britain and the United States in particular, who were responsible for the sanctions regime on Iraq and the consequences arising from it. And point out, of course, that since the Iraq experience, we have not seen a similar comprehensive sanctions package imposed on any other country. We're now moving towards smart sanctions, which, you know, we can argue for and against, but at least they are less directly impacting on the population. There's less an element of collective punishment, which, of course, is in violation of international law. So maybe things have moved on from that terrible Iraqi experience. So I'm focusing much now on the changes within the United Nations to ensure that these sort of things don't happen again, but also to looking at our failures in Rwanda and Burundi and other parts of the world, Sudan as we speak. In terms of Iraq, the questions I get nowadays are more to do with the invasion and its illegitimacy and a reluctant, endorsement up by the United Nations some 18 months later. That the consequences of that invasion, on top of sanctions, on top of the damage of the Gulf War, were quite catastrophic. We know today that conditions for the average person in terms of housing, education, healthcare, electric power, clean water, the situation is worse now than it was under Saddam Hussein in the mid-90s and at the end of the 90s. The occupation has further retarded and destroyed the infrastructure of this country. And the investment has not been made, and of course the insecurity situation makes it difficult to move forward. So we're in the process of looking at now a country which is in terrible condition, terrible shape. Oil prices, of course, now are down, which cuts off some of the revenue they need so desperately for infrastructural investment. And the United States is working its way out, perhaps. That's very nice, I'm sure, for the United States. But where are the reparations that need to be paid to the people of Iraq for the damage that have been done to this country now since 1990? I reckon something like $3-4 trillion U.S. dollars would begin to address the damage that the United States and its friends have done to the Iraqi people.
Oh, there's no question about that. We literally destroyed a country that was known as the cradle of civilization, and we've done the same thing in Afghanistan. I think the plan, Dennis, is certainly not to end the occupation, just pull it back to a smaller permanent force. Would build permanent U.S. bases, some of them so extensive that they're like small U.S. cities. I think for people, if people woke up out of a sound sleep and found themselves in one of these places, not knowing what country they were in, they'd probably think they were back home.
New Jersey.
Everything they get here, they can get on those bases.
That's right.
And they'd only know they were in Iraq if they went out outside the front gate into the country at large, like entering another world. So I think the occupation is intended to be permanent. It's very harsh. Of course, Afghanistan is the same thing, where Obama wants to send more troops over, intensify the situation there. And I truly believe that in the end, both occupations are untenable, and they will end. But how many more people have to die before that happens?
Exactly. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me that a man so brilliant as Obama can make the mistake of not getting out of Iraq cleanly and, as you say, leaving behind 40,000-50,000 troops, which really is a situation we have in Okinawa, we have in Korea after 50-60 years. And that is not going to make the Iraqis happy, and I don't think they're going to tolerate that. But, of course, time will tell. The other aspect that horrifies me is that Mr. Obama is determined to go into Afghanistan, expand in Afghanistan, if necessary, go into Pakistan. He actually spoke about tracking down bin Laden and killing him, as though assassination was appropriate under international law. Even U.S. domestic law, I believe, opposes the assassination of foreign leaders. It's just tragic to see the U.S. going into Afghanistan, which can only be only end in failure.
Oh, indeed. And your native land is Ireland, Dennis. And it's astonishing to me that, of course, the Brits are so close to us, Ireland being a separate country, but that part of the world, certainly the UK and the Brits are very closely allied to the US, especially since World War II. But they have a long, dismal history of occupying Afghanistan and Iraq, and they know what happened to them. And if they could resurrect some of the people who went through all of the terrible torment and the lives of the Brits lost during their very unsuccessful occupations, they would have some very nasty things to say to the current UK governments. That maybe using language like "Don't you lunatics learn any history? Don't you know what we went through before? We lost. You're losing now."
Yeah.
Get out and cut your losses. And my goodness gracious, Dennis, we have this terrible economic calamity going on globally. And to spend all of this money for military purposes that are absolutely futile when there are such immense needs domestically to help very needy people in all of the Western countries. And here we're pouring this into militarism instead. And just making a bad situation much worse.
You know, it's astonishing to me as an observer living here in New York that the American people tolerate policies like this, that they know they're in deep financial crisis. They have their own problems with mortgages and car leases and education and good things for their families and their children. And yet they're willing to tolerate this vast, vast expenditure, much of which is still hidden, I suspect, on futile and aggressive warfare overseas in violation of law, with no purpose that satisfies human need, human well-being, and does not even serve the United States effectively. Never mind the incredible damage it's doing to the infrastructure and the people of these countries, and setting up this appalling conflict which between East and West, or Islam and Christianity. I mean, it's something that nobody in this country should endorse.
I think the reason they tolerate it is they simply don't know what's going on, Dennis. The media doesn't really say very much about it. Way back, there were many reports about Iraq. Iraq is almost completely off the media agenda now. Not too many reports about Afghanistan. Pakistan, my God, I'll bet half the population that couldn't find Pakistan on a map. And the only time they know where any country is far, far away is when we go to war with them. But
that's
I think
right.
People don't realize just exactly what's going on, what the cost of it is. The actual military cost, if you put everything into the package, it isn't the official Department of Defense military budget. Oh, the next one, I think, maybe 500-odd billion, maybe 600 billion for fiscal year 2010. But if you put everything related to defense, including homeland defense, the actual U.S. military budget exceeds $1 trillion a year. Now, we can't afford this during normal times. My goodness, we certainly can't afford it now. We are literally, as Chalmers Johnson says, and he's been on this program, and he writes about this stuff often, we are bankrupting ourselves. We are digging such a deep hole that there's only one resolution in the end. We will go bust. And whether the global crisis does it or the militarism does it or a combination, this is coming down the road, and it's happened to other empires in the past. We're not exempt. It'll happen to us.
Yes, I think I agree with that fully. And it's astonishing that knowing this, and people like the Obama team certainly know this too, that they haven't been able to sort of explain it fully. Perhaps they're in the process of doing that, but that they're continuing policies which will run this country into the ground. And if the Chinese, for one reason or another, stop transferring billions of dollars every week into treasury bonds and other financial arrangements in this country, of course, this country will go bust. I mean, the financial bill for the military in this country is 10 times the entire NATO countries put together. And probably China, which has a budget of something like 20, 30 billion. Bad enough, waste of money too, but minuscule beside the real bill that you've mentioned of, say, $1 trillion U.S. dollars.
Well, we spend just about as much as the rest of the world combined. And of course,
oh,
we have
more.
We have black budgets, Dennis. Nobody knows exactly what we spend on CIA or all of the intelligent operations. One time I saw an estimate supposedly by a CIA insider a couple of years ago that their budget was on the order of $50 billion a year. How that came out and how accurate it is, who knows. But you've got that. We have 16 intelligence agencies in this country. Unfortunately, just the one CIA one is mostly a rogue one. The intelligence is almost a fig leaf for all of the other horrific things that they do. And so we get ex-CIA people leave in disgust. People like Ray McGovern and others that just don't want any part of this stuff. And we rampage around the world, assassinate heads of state, foment coup d'etats. A lovely way to run a country, Dennis. And then, of course, the foreign wars, and CIA always gets involved to one degree or another. And the secret prisons, of course, we have a under the Bush administration, we have an official policy of torture that I wrote about in great detail. That music needs another break, Dennis.
That's okay.
Let's take that and we'll come back.
Great.
Oh, my goodness. We need to do something to straighten things out. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
I followed Obama all through the presidential campaign. I've written numerous articles about him, quoted him on his voting record, who his funders were, and so on. None of this surprises me at all. But I also wrote back the first year under George Bush that his approval rating, Obama is very popular now. I think it will fade. George Bush's approval rating, he didn't do as well early on. It hovered around 50% until 9/11. Then he literally skyrocketed overnight to about 90%. And very slowly he started coming down. And he ended up with the lowest approval ratings of any president in U.S. history since they began polling. I don't know if Obama will sink that low, but given what he's doing, he certainly is doing very little to help needy people. He too will fall. It may take time, but I think people slowly will catch on that they're not being helped. And when they begin hurting badly enough, they'll blame the government. Who else?
Well, I mean, hopefully he will not fail. I mean, I would hope Mr. Obama would succeed. I mean, my interest is particularly foreign affairs, although I am obviously concerned about the domestic situation in this country. I know a lot of Americans are suffering in very difficult circumstances, losing their jobs and mortgages, and situation is really tragic for many who are innocent themselves and are swept away by these crooks in Wall Street here in Manhattan. And it's tragic. But I hope Mr. Obama will succeed. And I'm hoping he will see the light in regard to Iraq and in regard to Afghanistan. And he will open a dialogue with Iran and Syria and begin to insist that Israel respect international law and get itself out of the occupied territories and give the Palestinians a chance at least to have a small, if very strange, state. I mean, there's great things he can do, and let's hope he can do that. At the same time, to begin to address the issues that Mr. Bush left behind here in this country, of course they go way back before Bush in terms of health care and Social Security, and move away from the great fear that people have here in terms of any policy that looks remotely socialist. I mean, there's nothing evil about a program of government that encourages equality and gives everybody a fair break of living and housing and education and healthcare. That's not exactly a threatening, dangerous thing. It's exactly what seems to me good government is all about.
Oh, absolutely. We have sayings in this country going back. Abe Lincoln talking about government of, by, and for the people. And, of course, it just hasn't worked out that way. Ralph made a statement, something like government of General Motors by Exxon for Wall Street or something like that. I mean, basically serving a very small slice at the top, elitist interest. And I, too, hope that, somehow lights will go on. Maybe lights won't go on, Dennis, but maybe there'll be enough public angst that the powers that be will be forced to do more than they ever thought they'd have to. I think this is basically the way the New Deal came about. Roosevelt was a patrician, but public distress was so immense during the early years of the Depression that I think a decision was made that if we want to save capitalism, we sure better have some enlightened policies for very, very needy people. So we got the New Deal. We had some wonderful legislation. It was far from perfect. But my goodness, comparing what was done then by government to today, night and day, so far Obama has not done this. The plans that he's come out with, including stimulus and home mortgage help, they are counterproductive. It provides some fig leaf help. It really doesn't provide very much help at all. Far, far too limited. Again, continuing the foreign business that you spent all your time with, that we just have to extricate ourselves from, and maybe enough public angst will get these people to realize that they really need some new policies, because if they don't have it, there might be a public uprising.
Right. Well, you see, it goes back to what we discussed earlier, that Americans are extraordinarily tolerant or disinterested or perhaps not properly informed as to what's happening in Washington and who is working on their behalf or who is not. They don't perhaps understand that corporate America and Mr. Eisenhower's industrial, military, media, energy complex is running this country to suit itself and feed the very wealthy. Americans are astonishingly laid back and casual, and they deserve to look after themselves, to stand up and be more courageous, perhaps, in taking on a government. And I would have thought Obama is the sort of man who may not be interested in polls, but he certainly is interested in meeting the basic needs. And if he sees and gets signals from not just a couple of thousand or a couple of hundred well-meaning people, but from millions of Americans around the country, then he will begin to address the fundamentals, I would have thought, here in within the country.
Oh, indeed. I live in Chicago, Dennis, and back on November 4th, election night after he'd won, this city just erupted in celebration. I was not part of it. I knew people would end up at some point being disappointed, but there was just a mass street party celebrating the election of Obama. I think the combination of that and the end of 8 years under George Bush, that for certain was a reason to celebrate. But so far, well, he's less than 2 months in office, so you could say give the guy a break and let's see what comes from this point on. He's off to a very rocky start, but I hope, like you do, that something will change, something will happen, and we'll begin to get some enlightened policies. He's got 4 years ahead of him, and he darn well better do something, or heaven help all of us abroad and at home.
Absolutely. And one looks at his team, and I was looking at Hillary Clinton, who's now in the Middle East, of course, and, you know, is she able to turn around and change her own policies and her own instincts and what she said in the past vis-a-vis, let's say, Iran or Israel, and adjust that to a...
We need to break it.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome on. Welcome back. We're on with Dennis Halliday. Dennis, you mentioned Hillary Clinton, and I have certainly written about her and the run-up to her appointment, the campaign first off, and then her appointment as Secretary of State. She worries me greatly. She's very, very bellicose, and I remember one of the comments, I quoted somebody, I don't remember the person, but somebody referred to her during the campaign as a war goddess, a very frightening characterization, to say the least.
Yes. Well, her statement about decimating Iran and this, such, that's these are totally inappropriate wordage for somebody in her position to use and can be misunderstood, of course, very badly at the other end. Well, let's hope there's a miracle and there's a turnaround and she really is part of the Obama approach. But then he himself has made these huge mistakes with speaking with AIPAC and making commitments to Israel which are improper. and not in anybody's interests, and neglecting the Palestinians, and still refusing to talk to Hamas, although the Carter Center certified they were democratically elected. So there's a lot of work to be done there.
Oh, indeed. The Israeli-Palestinian situation is one of my core issues. We discuss it all the time on this program. And, of course, we had the horrific 22-day war beginning last December 27th on Gaza. And since the middle of 2007, Gaza has been under siege, literally a medieval siege, where essential-to-life things have not come in. People are real nourished, suffering terribly. Then we had that war. And Gaza is really in an absolute desperate situation.
Yes.
And it's still under siege.
That's right. I mean, they've cut off all exit in terms of people, in terms of trade, in terms of opportunities for education. It's just tragic. And during the, you called it a war, I would call it a massacre. But the what shocked me, amongst other shocks, was the fact that the Egyptians refused to open their border and allow even temporary Palestinian Gazan refugees to take find safety in Egypt pending an end to the Israeli attack. Extraordinary breach of international law. I mean, they have obligations. Right now, we have in Syria and Jordan 2 to 3 million Iraqi refugees, and these countries are taking them despite the pain and difficulty they're having doing that. But Egypt has simply closed its border. It's quite astonishing.
I think Egypt basically did it complicit with Israel and Washington.
Oh, yes,
They literally wanted to squeeze the Palestinians. Yeah. Israel has really had a policy going back to 1948, but after the last Lebanon War, 2006, they came up with something that they call the Dahiya Doctrine, which is basically we will level you to the ground after a town in Lebanon that they called Dahiya,
yeah,
that they leveled to the ground back in 2006. And I quoted Israeli officials in some of my writing basically explaining what they had in mind. And it basically came down to that, and that they would deliberately target civilians because they consider civilians a strategic target.
Yeah.
So go after all, and of course they did that in Gaza, deliberately attacking civilians, killing hundreds of children, an astonishing situation of crimes of war and against humanity, and the world stays silent on this. When any knuckles are wrapped in us, as we know, they're wrapped equally on both sides. So Gaza, Hamas is equally to blame as Israel. The old blame the victim game.
Yeah, of course, killing civilians is not new. I mean, we did that in Vietnam. We did it in the Second World War, destruction of Dresden and destruction of Coventry. I mean, it's tragic that killing civilians is proven to be effective, and it's continued. And the Israelis are not alone, as you quite rightly point out, and the Hamas rocketing, even with these homemade, totally ineffective devices, have killed 20 or 30 Israelis in the last 10 years. I mean, that's also unacceptable.
More Israelis die by car accidents probably in 1 year.
Of course.
But these rockets.
The rockets that
were used as a pretext
for
the massacre that began on December 27th. The rockets had nothing to do with it. The whole business was planned months in advance.
Yeah.
And Washington was involved, and of course we supply the weapons and billions of dollars in annual aid, and they just waited for a pretext, and if one didn't come along, they would have invented one, because this was what they wanted to do, and Hamas was targeted from the beginning after they were democratically elected. Hamas, Dennis, is the only truly democratically elected government in the Middle East, and I include Israel in that, because Israel provides rights for Jews, but not for 20% of its population who happen to be Arabs. They don't count.
Yeah, well, of course, now Mr. Lieberman and others are beginning to see the danger of this situation and what that represents for Israel, and whether it's a two-state solution or a so-called one-state solution. Things are not looking good. It's looking even more dangerous and more difficult.
Oh, I think that's right. Lieberman is really, if anyone in Israel is a fascist, then Avigdor Lieberman certainly fills the bill. But you've got Bibi Netanyahu, and he isn't exactly a progressive figure by any means.
No, he's now forced into a coalition with the extreme right, which doesn't help things either.
Oh, indeed, and I guess they'll end up with. I guess he's still working on it. I don't think he's got his coalition yet, has he?
Well, he's been rejected twice now by the current foreign minister. What's her name?
Livni.
She doesn't want to work with Netanyahu, so that leaves him not much choice.
Well, he's left with. With Lieberman and his Israel as Our Home Party, translated into English, and another group, one of the extreme religious parties, Shas, and they have, I think, about 15 seats in the Israeli Knesset out of 120.
Right.
No one party in Israel's history has ever won a majority because they have so many parties. So the current incumbent, Kadima, won, I believe it was 28 seats, and Netanyahu won 27, Likud, and he needs to come up with 61 to form a government. So you consult with all the riffraff of the world, and you create a government. But Netanyahu worries me greatly. He's very bellicose. But Livni, they try to outdo each other during the campaign, Dennis, each trying to sound more hawkish than the other, to stand up against this horde of defenseless Palestinians that may invade Israel and take over. I mean, it's astonishing, and most Israelis go along with this.
That's what's most disturbing, that they feel the need to go to the extreme right in order to get support, which implies that Israelis have come to a position where they're not going to change. They're going to continue the occupation of the West Bank. And they're not going to give it up, and they're heading for a situation. There was an extraordinary 60 Minutes piece about 3 or 4 weeks ago, which made the case very, very well, very effectively, unfortunately, that the possibility of a two-state solution has already passed its shelf life, because there are now over 500,000 Israelis living in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank, and they're not going to be likely to be moved.
Well, I agree. For some time, I have honestly believed that a two-state solution is not the answer. And if a country really wants to call itself a democracy and practice what it preaches, then it needs to respect all its citizens. I mean, should we take the United States, Dennis? Should we take your country, Ireland, or Northern Ireland, and have a separate state for Catholics and a separate state for Protestants? Or in the U.S., maybe a separate state for Christians, another one for Jews, another one for Muslims or whatever. I mean, we have one nation, our Declaration of Independence, one nation under God. We're ready for everybody combined, and there should be no religious involvement in the running of a government in any way. So for Israel to be a Jewish state, I think it was completely out of place back in the beginning. To me, that's an idea that simply isn't viable, and sooner or later it won't work. And I think Israel, the way it's going, will not survive in the long run. When they will come about, who knows? But I think the way that they've structured their government, where only Jews matter, nobody else, not even Christians. Christians only have rights, maybe a few more than Arabs. But this is no way to run a country. And when 20% of your population are Arab Muslims, you need to care for them. That's a very substantial segment of the people.
Well, there's clearly huge distrust. But I would agree with you that I don't understand the thinking of Israel, because if they're looking for the long term, they need to live with and work with their neighbors. And they have a lot to offer each other. I mean, if you could visualize a new Middle East of a sort of European model, perhaps, with Arab oil revenue and the brilliance of Palestinians overseas and many others who could return and would return, perhaps, if there was security and stability and good things. And then the Israeli expertise, which is quite extraordinary. I mean, I'm so old that I go back to working in Iran in the 1960s, when Tahal, the Israeli water management company, provided technical assistance to Iran. And if one is optimistic, I mean, and you can see a change in Israeli policy and a new togetherness evolving, the day when Israel and all the Arab states can work and live together and support each other, it's not impossible. In fact, it's the only way it's going to work, in my view.
oh, it's the only way forward. I think lots of people like Noam Chomsky, believes that Israel's policy as it exists today also was non-viable in Israel, unless Israel changes this terrible militancy, that they will end up destroying themselves.
Yes.
I honestly believe that myself, and I feel that this country will end up doing the same thing, the idea of living by the sword, and you will die by that sword. And in the Middle East, Israel is certainly an outlier, a Jewish enclave in an Arab-Muslim world. Well, there's no reason that they're there, and at this stage, they're not going anyplace. So I think Arab states would absolutely be willing to get along publicly, openly with Israel, if Israel would renounce its violence. But that began way back, pre-1948, a decision was made by the hardline Zionists that they would pursue violence as a strategic a way forward. And so there have been many wars in the region. Israel almost always, except for 1973, Israel is the belligerent. They attack the others, and others defend themselves, but they refer to Arabs as this horde of Arabs that threatens the survival of the Jewish state. Well, I think the Arabs are very concerned about their own survival, living in a neighborhood with a belligerent country like Israel, nuclear armed.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's the real danger. My goodness, this tiny country, population about the size of Greater Chicago, could unleash their nuclear weapons and wipe out the whole Middle East.
You see, American foreign policy needs to recognize the reality of that, and the fact that if you're sitting in Iran and you have all the statements coming out of Israel and the United States, and you're the only one who doesn't have nuclear weapons when nuclear weapons are being pointed at you from American bases in Turkey, undoubtedly now in Iraq itself, and of course from Israel and possibly from Pakistan. I mean, they're surrounded by very dangerous neighbors, and if you're sitting in the Iraqi shoes, the need to have some sort of nuclear defense is obviously being sold quite easily locally. Hopefully it will not happen. But it will not happen much quicker if Israel decides to be less belligerent and decide to live and work with its neighbors, which I think it's just common sense is the only way forward.
I think the key, Dennis, might be to get a change of philosophy here in Washington, because we supply so much aid to Israel that if we made it contingent on a new way there because we adopted a new way here, that would change everything. But as long as Washington is so belligerent, it's a partnership between the two countries, and they both pretty much pursue the same policies.
But we do have a history. I mean, Eisenhower did at one stage stop, I believe, aid and military aid to Israel. Isn't that correct? And that could happen again.
Israel was a pretty new country back then. I honestly don't know. I know the aid really picked up in intensity after the 1967 war. I think it was pretty small stuff before then. Although the U.S., I think there was small amounts of aid, and the U.S. was the first country in 1948. Harry Truman was the first country minutes after Israel declared itself as a state on May 14, 1948. We recognize Israel, and I saw a copy of the official document with something very brief, just a couple of sentences, and I quoted it verbatim, and there was something actually crossed out. I guess Truman must have crossed out a word or two and wrote in something else. Didn't really change much of anything, but I thought that was interesting, and we did it right after midnight, I believe, on May 14th. So there was aid that always went, but I think after the 67 war, where the Johnson administration was mired in Vietnam, and Israel rolled over its adversaries in 6 days, 1967, and we were very impressed by that. We knew that we had an ally we needed to rely more on, so we started supplying all of this money and weapons and the rest to this day, tens of billions of dollars.
The period I'm speaking of, I think, is 1956, when the British and the French, supported by Israel, attempted to take over the Suez Canal, and America stepped in and stopped it, which was really impressive. I'm not sure it could happen today, but they stopped it, and they stopped Israel in its tracks, and I think Eisenhower suspended all aid to Israel. So there is a precedent for tough love, if that's the word, that could be used. The blind policy now, which Obama has endorsed, is very dangerous. And I think it misleads the Israelis into thinking they can do things which, in fact, they cannot do and survive at the same time.
Oh, I am old enough too, Dennis. I'm in my mid-70s. I think I have a vague memory going back to that actual period. I think part of that problem was that Israel acted without checking with Washington on the advisability of doing it, or with its European neighbors back then. And we weren't too upset with their suddenly taking over the Suez, and they hadn't checked with Washington first. So Eisenhower absolutely slapped them on the wrist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's a different situation today, and now I think it was Nixon that came up with a term referring to countries like Israel and Turkey as our cops on the beat, to be there to guide that oil treasure that we value so much.
Well, then, given what you said earlier, Steve, about the fact that Iraq is now going to be occupied for, who knows, 20, 30, 40, 50 years maybe, the need for Israel actually is diminished because the U.S. bases in Iraq, as you said, are the size of small cities, and they're not going to be given away, I don't think, anytime soon. That the strategic presence of this military force and nuclear armed force in the Middle East, in Iraq, is going to be extraordinary, making Israel somewhat redundant for American foreign policy.
Well, there's still Iran to contend with, and Israel wants to be the absolute supreme power in the Middle East. Iran is a threat to no one, to absolutely no one, but we make them out to be a threat.
Yes.
And Israel wants to eliminate the supremacy of Iran or the power of Iran, just like what we did to Iraq. So we've got that situation to deal with. Oh, my goodness, there's so much, Dennis. It keeps us both busy.
Absolutely.
We need to take another break. Welcome back. We're on with Dennis Halliday. Dennis, we just have a few minutes left. Let me let you finish up with what you say when you're speaking to groups, and maybe a little bit of hope in your message, too. I'm certain you deliver that.
Yes, I always try to wrap up, whether it's the UN or whether it's foreign policy of the United States and NATO and the EU. We've got to learn to respect international law. We've got to learn to respect the human rights of everybody, not just ourselves, but everybody overseas. They have the same dreams and hopes and prayers for their families, and we must respect that and work with them. We need to recognize that aggression and warfare, whether it's legal or not legal under international law, does not work. It does not produce the results we all care about. We've made huge mistakes in Iraq. We've made a terrible mistake in Afghanistan, and we're continuing to make those mistakes. So I think one has to be optimistic, however. We have a new president of the United States. Maybe he can bring change to the United Nations. That would be my hope, and see some new north-south balance in the decision-making there in the Security Council. And that he would bring a change to foreign policy of the U.S. itself, and that he would talk to the Iranians and talk to the Syrians and change the view of Afghanistan and Pakistan and help these people to live within their own borders and to adjust their lifestyle in a way which is compatible with international law and human rights, the same human rights as we fail to live with and address in this country, for example. So there's lots of work to be done. And I think Americans are good people. They need good leadership. They need to understand what's happening. And let's hope Mr. Obama is the right man, that he will have the courage to do the unpopular thing, and he'll change foreign policy, which will serve not just the best interests of the United States, which would be the case, but serve the best interests of womankind and mankind around the globe. And we are so interdependent, given the climate change and other problems which we face together.
Well, if he did that, Dennis, he certainly would go down in history as a truly great leader, and one that we have been waiting for so long.
Well, let's hope he does. I mean,
oh,
I hope
he
delightful.
Does.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I honest to goodness hope he does. I live with hope when the things I write about seem so black and disturbing, and yet when people respond to me with similar thoughts, I say to them that I live with hope. I absolutely never lose hope, because if we lose hope, we lose everything.
Now, we can never give up and never stay silent.
Oh, absolutely. And you've seen it with all of your UN work, and you preach it, and I want to preach it too. And I would say I wish Obama and his people all the luck in the world and the wisdom to see the right path ahead and follow it. People will respond with all of the problems we have to deal with under normal conditions. My goodness, to take on all of these other things and make things worse, it doesn't make sense for me.
No, absolutely.
Dennis, it's been wonderful having you on. We'll hear the music strike up again momentarily, and they'll cut away to the next program. But I just want to thank you for coming on. It's really been a thrill for me to have you on. I've respected you and your work for so long.
Well, Steve, you're very kind, and I'm delighted to be on your program.
Well, I wish you well with what you'll do ahead. I'll do my best as well, and you'll be traveling home a bit very shortly, and I wish you safe travels.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And to listeners, please come back tomorrow. We'll have another live program. Join us then. Oh, I thought I heard the music. No music yet? Oh, there it is. There it is. Tomorrow we'll discuss. Oh, they're going to break away. Tomorrow we'll discuss immigration. We'll discuss how it ill serves some people. Please come back. Please join us then.